Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. It's always a pleasure to have you hang out with us here on the NOLA Drink Show. I hope everyone has had a terrific Memorial Day weekend. I hope everyone had a chance to reflect on what that means to those of us here in the United States. We should have had a lot of time on our hands, right, to be able to do so. It's very important, especially times like now, to think about those that paid the ultimate sacrifice for us, especially right now when we're being asked to sacrifice so little for the betterment of our community. So please keep that in mind. I hope everyone out there is doing what they're supposed to be doing, being responsible, being a good neighbor, being a good friend, being a good citizen. It's important stuff, friends. We all owe it to each other. It's not all about us. And I think especially on this weekend, again, when we think about all the people that gave their lives to serve the United States, it's very little, as I said just a second ago, to ask us to do what we need to do to continue to keep ourselves safe and healthy. Have a really good show coming up for you here. Very excited about this one. Kind of a special treat. We're joined by my good friend, Phil Minasalli, who is a spirits broker, consultant, and educator. Operates PM Brokerage here out of New Orleans, Louisiana. And Phil and I started doing a series called Liquid Luggage. As a matter of fact, we were able to do our first installment of Liquid Luggage right before the coronavirus situation, maybe a few weeks, not too long before it all broke out. So it kind of put the kibosh on it for a little while, but we got it going again. And normally you would only hear that on the podcast. And what we do in Liquid Luggage, it airs on the podcast version of the show. So if you are listening on the radio, go to noladrinks.com, look at the homepage, scroll down, you'll see the Liquid Luggage segments. We also air it in Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, which is our podcast only segment that we do with every show. So it airs periodically there. But you don't generally hear it on the radio. So what we decided to do to kind of bring it back after being on hiatus for a little while was we did two Liquid Luggage episodes, number two and number three. And if you're listening on the radio, you get to hear number two. We're going to start out with the featured interview, talking with Phil, just kind of to learn a little bit about what he does, what a spirits broker is, kind of how it fits in the supply chain. And then we're going to do Liquid Luggage number two. As I said, we're going to taste some couple really interesting whiskeys from Deadwood. It's actually made by the guy, David Schmier, who was one of the two guys behind Redemption Whiskeys. This is his new project, some really interesting and tasty stuff. And then in Liquid Luggage number three, that you're only going to hear on the podcast, we explore some really interesting spirits, three, in fact, from Latin America. Really, really cool stuff. All these things have a great sense of place. That's kind of what Phil builds his portfolio, his book around, as he seeks unique and interesting spirits, both from the United States and obviously from afar. And we taste a couple cocktails with some of the ingredients that we have. Oh, and we also taste in Liquid Luggage number two, a very nice Geneva as well. And we've talked about Geneva on the show before, and we make a Negroni variation called the Dutch Negroni. You'll learn why. Also, and that's in Liquid Luggage number two, the second part of that one. So we wanted to bring that to you here today. This is the point, so you could actually hear Liquid Luggage for yourselves if you're a radio listener. Maybe encourage you to go get the podcast, because then you're going to be able to hear all the Liquid Luggages as we roll them out. But we also do put them on our website after the show airs. We break them out individually, so you could just hear those segments, get the cocktail recipes in question, see bottle shots of the different stuff that we taste, as well as links to those products and all kinds of useful information. So good for you if you're a bartender, ways to use these unique things, and good for you if you're a consumer, because you can pick up most of these things on the shelf at your favorite retailer, or go ask them for it. They can get most of this stuff, and that way you can check it out and make these drinks at home as well. That's kind of the idea behind Liquid Luggage, friends. So really interesting stuff. Thanks to Phil for joining us on the show. We're going to take a brief break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then be right back with Phil Minasalli talking about what it's like to be a broker, then Liquid Luggage number two, and then on the podcast, oh yeah, Liquid Luggage number three. Be right back here, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Cultural Drink Show, friends. Yeah, always happy to have you here and happy to be bringing you a really fun show on a whole host of levels. I mentioned some of this at the top of the show. We're sitting here with our good friend, Phil Minasalli, who is my partner in crime as we do the liquid luggage segment. We'll get to that in a little bit because we're bringing you two of those on this show, at least two. If you're listening to the podcast, go get the podcast, one on the radio. But we want to start with this, Phil. You're a spirits broker. And I think a lot of people out there probably know, they know what a producer is, right? That's who makes the stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you know where you procure it, meaning the liquor store, the bottle shop, the restaurant,
yeah,
that
the
kind of thing.
The retail outlet.
The retail, on-premise, mm-hmm. off-premise. You might know those terms. So that's the first tier, the producer. The third tier is the where you get it, where you buy it as a consumer. And you may, a lot of you may know, I'm sure most of you know, what the second tier is, where that's used, and that's the distributor, the person who brings it into the state or the area. And then what they do is, you know, they have their sales force and they go out and sell it to that third tier. But there's a couple other pieces that can happen in the supply chain. Certainly one would be an importer bringing in stuff from outside the country. But you're a spirits broker first and foremost. So tell people, what do you do? What is a spirits broker?
It's a conversation that like is about supporting the existing brands or helping brands get a foothold into a market. So I exist primarily to support craft brands. I mean, everything that I've been about is supporting an independently owned craft product. And I started it because I wanted to continue to work in the craft field, but I know this market, as in New Orleans or Louisiana. Great market of consumption per capita, but relatively a small market. Uh-huh. So when you look at the total population of Louisiana, that's the population of Atlanta and the greater Atlanta area. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot more sales to be had in different markets. So that's why I developed the brokerage company to diversify. So just, I live, when you were discussing the tiers, I live kind of between both of those worlds. Mm-hmm. I live between the first, the supplier,
the producer, yep.
and the wholesaler.
Mm-hmm.
So what I like to do is I help introduce the product, the producer directly to the wholesaler. I want to establish the confidence in their ability to sell it. So I'm going there, I'm meeting with them. Granted, the supplier can't just come to New Orleans to sit down with the sales team and taste the product. So it might take a week, it might take 3 months to activate a product into the market. And then where I live on the other side is between the wholesaler and the retailer,
okay.
or mm-hmm. the bar and restaurant.
Yep.
So I act as like an independent contracted sales representative or sales consultant that supports the distributors. Along the way.
Right. So that's really well explained. So, and we're using, I just want to make sure people are clear. We're using the term supplier and producer interchangeably distributor and wholesaler interchangeably. So you're kind of, like you said, putting yourself between the first and second tier, second and third tier.
Mm-hmm.
But your affiliation though, Phil, is it fair to characterize it in a way that you're more affiliated with the supplier or the producer? You have a great working relationship with the wholesaler and have an affiliation, but you're more directly, you're working for the brand, right?
Right. Yeah. So I will create programming, events, tastings, all of this. Of course, I want to relay and communicate as much of that to the distributor, because if they see that I'm doing all this work, I want to make sure they know I'm out there doing the
doing
work.
Stuff. Not just sitting home drinking samples.
Right. So it gives me an opportunity to really speak on behalf of the brand. So I'm contracted directly. It gives me a really great position to not only educate the distributor and their sales force, but to educate the consumer through retail tastings, through a cocktail event at a bar or a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and I want to make sure people understand this too, because sometimes when we're talking about the producer or the supplier, okay, they might be in the neighboring state, and I think we're going to taste something that's out of the neighboring state here from Louisiana in the next round, in the next segment. But you could also be talking about, we're going to taste something in the third one, and the second liquid luggage we do today, that might be all the way from the Southern Hemisphere. So these brands are not necessarily within spitting distance. Lots of times you're seeking these out in these relationships with brands, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but brands that are really found afar and oftentimes maybe don't have much of a presence either in our market or even in the country.
Sure. I've made it a point to build the the portfolio as a book of spirits with a sense of place. You hear that description quite a bit now. So I have traveled down to South America, and I've been introduced to spirits down there that are new and exciting and kind of challenging the classic approach to how things are done. And that's kind of always been the MO. Mm-hmm. I've always been attracted to how a product is made and also where it comes from, how that terroir is impacting the final product.
Okay. Now, how do you, and I know this could be any number of sets of answers to the story, but, you know, do you find this stuff through research, by happenstance, where you meet somebody, going to trade stuff? Is it all of the above?
All of the above. Okay. Yeah. So we'll talk about a couple segments, a couple spirits in the other segment, but sometimes it's just on the baseball field. Someone's like, oh, I met a guy when I was traveling in Argentina, yeah, and I tasted this product. I got his business card. You should reach out to him. You do this kind of thing, right?
Right.
Like, that's exactly what I do.
It's actually really funny, and we'll get to Tricol in the second segment in the podcast, only segment that we do with Liquid Luggage, because sort of coincidentally, the way I was introduced, or at least first told about the spirit, was sitting at one of our favorite bars here in New Orleans, Sylvain, and I happened to be sitting next to a guy who had a relationship with the brand. So yeah. Then when I found out that you had the brand, you're telling me about it, I'm like, I know what it is. How did that happen?
I'm in the
sitting
now.
Sitting at a bar. Yeah, I'm in the now. I'm like sitting at a bar. Oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, so it's a combination of all those things. I have sought out, because I have relationships through my previous job working for a local rum company. I was a national sales director, so it gave me an opportunity to travel and work with other distributors across the country.
Okay.
And I saw what lived there, and I saw what was successful in those markets, and I kept it always in the back of my mind to say, hey, like, if I do this next step and sort of diversify the portfolio, I definitely want to make sure that product lives with me down here in New Orleans.
Okay, cool. Let me ask you this, because I know you're a fine musician as well as doing this, and you mentioned meeting somebody on the baseball field. I'll say at worst, you're a good utility ball player. I haven't actually seen you play, so I'm just giving you a hard
time.
shag some flies. So how did you find yourself in this industry, man?
I always was in sales. I think the classic sales job is a traveling salesman, and that's what I did with my guitar.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. It actually makes a lot of sense.
You are a traveling salesman. I mean, the first traveling musicians were like selling apothecary goods, rolling into town on like a caravan and selling stuff. And
absolutely.
There was all these jingles, like the first music that people started to hear on like a local level was
and then
like
regional level.
Regional level was hearing people come into town and entertain people. And there was always a sale attached to it. So I like to say that was the first sales job I ever have.
Yeah.
I was slinging $10 CDs all across the Northeast and into the South. And that's kind of how I was first introduced to New Orleans. And I took some other jobs in sales. I always loved the water. I grew up sailing, so I got into boating sales. And then when I turned the ripe age of 21 and could legally drink at bars, I found myself, pretty passionate in how things were made and where they were coming from and diving into the cocktail world. And once I made the leap to move to New Orleans, it seemed like this is a great sales gig that would support, me going out and playing shows and this.
Sure,
and that.
Absolutely. And you mentioned at the top of the segment here that, our per capita drinking here in New Orleans is pretty solid. So you could pretty easily look around and say, what do people in New Orleans like? It did not take rocket science to figure that one out, did it?
Yeah. It was a quick study.
You were a quick study, right on. So, you and I, and this all makes sense, and I wanted to kind of have this conversation with you because we really never, you've been on the show 2, 3, 4 times, but we've never been able to kind of talk about what a broker is and what it is that you do and your background. So I wanted to make sure we got that in there. And this all makes sense because we together have created this ongoing segment called Liquid Luggage. Mm-hmm. We did one. I'll ask people to go to the website, go to noladrinks.com, and you'll see it right there on the homepage. We managed to get one off the way we intended to do it before the coronavirus. And so now we're coming into Act 2, I'll call it, of coronavirus. So we're doing this in the socially distant environs of your house. But this all makes sense, man, because you're talking about, we call it liquid luggage because it's sort of like have guitar, will travel. Have bottle, will travel for you, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And these products, they have a voice to them from the producer onward. You know, and my job is to make sure that that stays consistent, because a lot of things can get lost. Just like any whisper down the lane, you know, the story can change drastically, and that might impact someone like the producer. So I really make it a point to study up, to make sure I know what I'm talking about when it comes to these products, and showing them the respect that they deserve. Mm-hmm. And our community, can't speak for every market I've ever been to, but this community shows spirits great respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that oftentimes, for example, bartenders, and I think this is the case in many places, but especially here, as you said, if I'm hearing you right, they're the gatekeepers for a lot of this, right? So we want them to know these products, these yeah. great spirits, because they're the ones who are going to use them in drinks and then tell people about them, because sort of like we were talking about storytelling through music, bartenders are storytellers also.
Absolutely. And my business wouldn't exist. It wouldn't have been successful had I not established the relationships with the bartenders and got in front of them.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I still drive and put the miles in, you know. I got to drop into the buyers. I schedule the appointments, and I make sure that they're ready to taste these products, or at least look at the bottles and hear the story about the brand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think this is worth mentioning too, and I'll say this in a very careful way, but you know, you're working with the brand, so you're one degree at worst separation from the brand itself. Whereas, and I'm not trying to dismiss anything, but you know, wholesalers, they got a big book. And so reps are always trying to juggle what they're taking out and showing the reps that work for the wholesalers, what they're showing. And I think in your case, because I've had some experience doing this in the wine world, in a position like that, you're able to better tell the story of the brand. So you're adding support to the rep, and you're coming across perhaps as maybe more authentic or closer to the source. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I would say how this has came about is I love these small distributorships, because, you know, you're right, when a large distributor, and you can name a couple that are just massive, mm-hmm. the education component, it may not necessarily still be there.
It's hard to memorize 500 things,
right? Right. And it's also, they know where the money is. You know, right now, it's business as usual. So like introducing a new product to the brand, it might develop the conversation of like, oh, well, what do you want me to replace it with? And I think what I bring to the table is, this isn't replacing anything. this is something different,
right?
And that can live next to an existing category. Like, you know, some of the South American spirits, like certain rums that are really heavy bodied versus the mixing rums, or like Indian whiskey, it can live in the whiskey section, and you don't want to replace a bourbon with an Indian whiskey.
Right.
You want to introduce an Indian whiskey to a bourbon consumer or a Scotch consumer, because it diversifies your selection at the bar and makes your watering hole like even more attractive.
More interesting. And same with your retail shelf, right? I think that's great.
Absolutely.
Well, here's what we're going to do, Phil. We're going to take a little break here on the show, on the radio, and we wanted to give you a special treat if you're a radio listener, because normally as we move forward doing these Liquid Luggage installments, again, go visit NOLADrinks.com. You'll find it there as these sort of standalone little vignettes that we do, and we'll be doing more of. But this one, so those will normally air just on the podcast portion of the show, but we're going to bring you one right here when we come back here on the radio as well as the podcast, so you can get a taste of what I do with Phil in Liquid Luggage. And then we encourage you to go get the podcast, because you can learn about a lot more spirits and connect with a lot of other cool stuff that way. So friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to come back with my good friend Phil Minasalli. We're going to get into some whiskey. We're going to get into some Geneva. And we're going to have a Negroni variation, friends. Come on back. All right, everybody. Yep. Welcome to Liquid Luggage episode number 2. Here we are, the with our good friend and partner in this endeavor, Phil Minasalli, Spirits Broker from PM Brokerage. And we're going to talk about a few things in this local luggage segment, friends. We're happy to bring it to you. Right now, we're talking whiskey, Phil, and we've got a couple fine examples thereof in our glasses.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about spirits with a sense of place, bourbon.
Yeah,
this is one that people know in the U.S. This can't be made anywhere else. Rye whiskeys are very commonly produced here as well. So we got a couple in our glass right now. We got the Deadwood Rye. This is a 95% rye, 5%.
And that's pretty high even for a rye. Or is that kind of the norm for a rye?
I think this particular mash bill is going to, I mean, other than a pure rye, like 100% rye,
yeah,
which is not as common.
Yeah.
The 95.5 is a very known mash bill for rye whiskey.
And is the 5 corn?
The 5 is actually malted barley.
Malted barley.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
So this one has that right up spiciness that you get from your ryes. The aromatics are that they're awesome. I get like a candied note to it as mm-hmm. well. What's really beautiful about this particular, so Deadwood is a source. It's a source whiskey. It is barreled in Kentucky. It's all going to be in Kentucky, but if you'll look on the bottle, it will say distilled in Indiana and Tennessee.
Okay.
So it's going to be meticulously sourced from those locations. And the gentleman that built the Deadwood brand is well known for building a very, very successful brand that's still successful now, which is, why am I blanking on it right now? It's Redemption.
Redemption, that's right. I think I knew that, actually.
Redemption, yeah. So Redemption Rye is one of Dave's first projects that he worked in the bourbon and the American whiskey segment, and then sold to a larger group and immediately started putting down barrels again.
Okay.
So right now, these are the first initial releases from his company called Proof and Wood Ventures. And it's only going to explode into some really amazing expressions. He's not just getting rye. He's getting bourbon. He's getting a light whiskey, which is really, really cool. He also has different mash bills of each of them.
Okay. So. Now, there's a couple things that are striking me on this. I find this very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this will play nice in a lot of cocktails. I mean, it's pretty versatile, really, I think, in a lot of ways. The other thing, and people, you can find shots of the bottle, so you'll see what I mean when I'm talking about this, on our Liquid Luggage segment. Go to the NOLADrinks.com homepage, look for the Liquid Luggage banner, click on it, look for episode 2, you'll see it there. It's a larger bottle, isn't it?
It is. It's a liter bottle.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole focus, is the approachability factor and the cocktail ability factor for bartenders. So this is a beautiful tall liter bottle that fits beautifully in a rail.
Mm-hmm.
So it, like some of the other spirits that I'll talk about, having that ability to be approachable, not just for the way it tastes, but physically in a rail. Those big square bottles and this and that sometimes don't make sense.
Sure.
Or the short squatty bottles sometimes don't make sense. It
right.
has to be something you could easily grab.
Holds a little more liquid, so you don't have to go
yep.
fetch another bottle.
Yeah, yeah. A high volume situation, it is really friendly for that type of bartender.
And what kind of, as it relates to that, Phil, what are we talking about price point here? How is it? Where is it priced to kind of sit on a bar list, and or if you're looking, you know, just pick it up retail?
Yeah, it's a great price from the wholesaler. Retail, you can get the liter bottle for $25.
Okay.
So it is a great value whiskey, and you will not be disappointed for how it tastes.
Mm-hmm. I think you're exactly right. There's some nice, and there's a little, some almost honey note to it. And
mm-hmm.
I get some nice bright, almost like white stone fruit kind of note to it. There's
yeah,
a nice
like,
fruity note to it.
Yeah. Like a peach.
Like a peach note. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And I've tasted this before and I didn't quite catch that the first time, but it's popping a little more to me now.
Yeah. It's opened up a little bit.
Opened up a little bit. That bottle's been sitting there in my care for some time. I brought it back to you and I didn't drink all of it.
I am impressed.
Thank you. And I'm not saying, and it's, let me tell you out there, friends, it's not because I didn't like it. It's because I was trying to be a good friend and partner in Liquid Luggage to my buddy Phil.
Thank
people,
you.
Sure, people can believe that if they want to. But it's true. It's very true.
If you said to me, you know what? I don't have that bottle anymore. I wouldn't have been that upset.
I kind of figured you wouldn't, so maybe you'll let me take it home again. How's that? And then I'll just bring you back an empty bottle.
There you go.
So we've got another Deadwood expression here also. Go ahead and tell us about this one. It's a heavy rye mash bill, but we're talking bourbon.
Right. So a good segue from the rye 95.5. Now you're dealing with what is known in the industry as a high rye bourbon. So rye brings some spice. I think it brings a lot of complexity. It also cuts down on a touch of that sweetness that a heavier corn bourbon will. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So compared to the Tumbling Dice, we do have a Deadwood bourbon, but that guy is going to be a 75-21 rye, 4% malted barley. So this gives you just a bit more. Less corn, 60%, 36% rye, and 4%. Percent barley. So it does bring out quite a bit of complexity. And Tumbling Dice is the brand that also is going to be this expression, which will be a small batch, so a bunch of barrels, say 10 to 15 barrels, that are all going to be put together, and it'll be proofed down to 100 proof.
Okay.
So 50% there. In addition to that, Dave has made single barrels accessible to markets as well, with the support of the 100 proof, this 3-year age statement bourbon.
It's interesting because it first impressions, Phil, as I sip it, it's certainly not as sweet as one might expect from a bourbon, very much as you said.
Right.
So that heavy rye mash bill is exactly how you mentioned it to me. And then with 100 proof, it brings some heat in a good way. So this to me is kind of an ideal, if you want to use it in a cocktail, this is an ideal cocktail where you need that proof to kind of pop and you don't want a lot of outside sweetness coming in.
Sure. Sure. I love this one. Neat for the youthfulness of it. I think it's a sweet spot for a young bourbon. 3 years is that. Now, granted, that is, again, a minimum age. So there may be other barrels that will fall in at 4 or 5 or 6 years. It just all comes down to the blending process, finding that sweet spot of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Also, color. You know, there's going to be no added color, so everything's coming from the barrels. So when you think about that, not every barrel is going to mature the same way. It's its own living creature.
Absolutely.
So you put 10 barrels up on the same particular day in a similar charred barrel, the same size, they are all going to taste a little bit different. So that's the beauty of the single barrel program, is it gives you like a really finite, you know, expression of what this particular whiskey can do in one barrel versus the barrel that might be 30 feet away from it in a different part of the warehouse.
Gotcha. So we got a couple minutes, maybe a minute left, Phil, before we're going to take a brief pause. What's the price point on this roughly retail?
35 to 40.
Okay. Make a mean old fashioned, without a doubt. There's one other little note that I want to mention to people on it, that I'm getting on the tasting note. I'm getting this nice little kind of saline note on it that, especially on the palate, that actually to me, and don't get me wrong, it doesn't taste like scotch, but it kind of harkens to that, especially on the finish. I find that really interesting, and I think that could be really just nice on the rocks and that way.
Yeah, there's great depth to this bourbon. I do think that high rye mash bill, to my palate, brings a bit more complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Like this mash bill will stand up to world whiskeys in terms of character, whereas that higher corn mash bill sort of lives within that realm. Of American whiskey.
Okay, cool. Well, friends, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a brief pause here, and then we're going to come back and taste another very interesting spirit called Geneva. We're going to make an interesting connection to whiskey since we just tasted some whiskeys, and we're going to tell you about how to make a classic Negroni, but we're going to use Geneva instead of gin, and we'll probably make that connection too, friends. Brief pause here on Liquid Luggage, episode number 2.
Well, my bucket's got a hole.
Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya.
All right, we're back, Liquid Luggage friends. Episode number 2 with our good friend Phil Minasalli from PM Brokerage. And Phil, we have a very interesting spirit here. Now we just went through a couple of nice expressions of whiskey from Deadwood. And now we're going to taste a Genever, and we've talked about Genever on the show before. It's an ancestor of gin, I think is kind of fair to say, but it's its own thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's got its own, in the wine world you would use, just in the spirit world, the AOC.
Yeah.
So as of 2008, the Dutch government, EU, created the official AOC for Genever.
And where does it come from? Where's the geographic range that's primarily?
So you're going to look at Holland is the original location. So the Netherlands being like one of the original locations, a town called Schiedam is where all of the original Genevers were coming from.
Right.
And what's fun about Genever is when you think of how trade was happening at the time, Genever was at one point the number one consumed spirit in the world, traded spirit in the world.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. And there are some areas that because of colonialization and all these, you know, trade routes that led, bringing a bottle of Genever to some, say, like a tribe in Africa is still a welcomed greeting.
Oh, really? Right. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that part of the story. Okay, yeah. That's really cool.
This is one of the strange things that's happened because of the history.
And the Dutch being all over the world, right? And so they're carrying Genever on ships, and that makes all the sense in the world. So, and friends, I will tell you that we did, as I mentioned, we did a show not too long ago on Genever. I'll put that in the show notes and liquid luggage notes. So if you want to hear more about the spirit, we're talking about this one here in particular, Phil. So I'd like you to talk about By the Dutch, and it's the old Genever. And let's talk about the mash bill, because we tasted some whiskeys before, and I think what's really interesting here is maybe, you know, I'm not a gin guy, and that's why I brought up the relationship, if you will, with gin. This might be a nice kind of bridge thing. You're going, I'm not a gin guy. Well, if you're a whiskey guy, you might find something in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or gal.
Sure, yeah. Whiskey gal, guy.
Guy, sorry.
I
want to be.
I really like this because it shows you we don't have, I mean, sure, we do like a White Dog whiskey. Remember that time when everyone was drinking white whiskey? It was like, it was a thing. Mm-hmm. So granted, this is a much more complex process. They are using the traditional, you know, column distillation, pot stills. There's a three distillations, but you are starting with those three same ingredients. You've got fermented wash, that's barley, malted barley, corn, and rye. And rye, as we discussed in the Deadwood whiskey, rye can have like this strong, really aromatic. But if it's like really, really present, it can almost bring like a little bit of a harshness. So it's typically not 100%. You have something to soften it. Barley is commonly used because it has all the enzymes, which are really critical in the fermentation process.
Okay.
So like the super starches and enzymes that help bond everything together. And corn is known for kind of that sweetness.
Bringing some sweetness, yeah.
And cutting a little bit of the harsh flavor that could come from like a 100% rye wash.
Right.
So it covers all the grounds for a early American whiskey.
Right. It makes sense, right? We're just, we kind of have the malt, the up front and center. Then the barley's more front and center than what maybe it would be in an American whiskey.
Sure. And in early trade, being Genever was one of the first introduced spirits to other parts of the world, it might have influenced some American production methods.
That's reasonably speculated.
So yeah, you're dealing with the wash. You got a first distillation, a second distillation. The third distillation is where you're going to get the botanical influence. So juniper is going to be the juniper berries. Then you essentially have your malt base from that, and then blended, and then you have the traditional Genever.
Yeah, and it's really smooth, it's really clean, and I think one significant contrast to gin is that the botanicals take more of a back seat to the mash bill,
and
right?
And the body, the complexity of the body, where, you know, you hear the language dry in terms of gin. I think that dryness and that descriptor comes from the distillation methods that soften the body, like bring the body to a really light place.
Right.
That, I think, is synonymous with our palate as recognizing dry versus sweet or full or heavy.
Right.
And this distillation process really retains the structure.
Absolutely.
And the depth. of the spirit.
Super clean, super nice. And then what we've done here too, friends, we've made a cocktail with it. And we've talked about this on the show before, not too long ago, with a Negroni. And so what, Phil, basically what you've done is you've made a Negroni instead of using gin, use Geneva. Now the Negroni, of course, is one part gin, one part vermouth, usually sweet vermouth, and then one part, well, Campari being the big brand, but an aperitivo, right?
Yeah.
And in this case, what have you done here? And tell us just in a couple minutes.
So
about
the Dutch
this drink.
Negroni, as
that's what we're calling this, is the Dutch Negroni, right?
Okay. As by the Dutch would ask me to describe it.
Fair
as,
enough. Fair enough.
We're going with the Dutch Negroni, so we have equal parts, just like any type of bitter, you know, cocktail base. You have one part of your Geneva, one part of your bitter liqueur, one part of your vermouth. So what I did is I took by the Dutch, I took Tuve, which is a, we were discussing some liqueurs and some vermouths previously. This is a really fun one. It has a touch more sweetness, but it also uses the original coloring methods to get the depth. And if you know your history of bitter liqueurs in Italy, they use a beetle. So that color comes from that. So for your gluten-free people, maybe not your liqueur to go
okay,
to
fair
go
enough.
With.
Word of advice there. Good one. Okay.
Because this will use the original coloring. And then I went with their line of vermouths, which are called Drappo, and I went with the rosé because it kind of balances out the dry white vermouth with the sweeter red vermouth. And it's great just on its own. Children eat aperitivo, but I think it really enhances the spirit base
yeah,
with the body here.
I dig it, man, because I think what would happen too if you were to use a heavier, sometimes my problem with a Negroni, the vermouth choice to me is so much of what makes a Negroni a Negroni.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're using this really cloyingly sweet, medicinal tasting sweet vermouth, it can be a really heavy drink. And
yeah.
and this is so light. This is kind of like a summer Negroni to me. And I think if you used one of those heavier sweet vermouths out there, you would basically just run the Geneva over. And we're getting some of the notes from the Geneva that are coming through. I taste the mash bill, you know, with the grains in there, and I'm getting a little bit of the botanical. And then we just get that nice bitter note from the bitters from the Tuve. And then the rosé just brings a nice, like, light touch of fruit and this lighter body kind of airy characteristic to it.
Yeah, I think some of the tasting notes on the finish of the Geneva can be, like, a little baking spice. You know, you could have a little bit of, like, the bitter orange and the cinnamon and the clove
yep.
present on the finish because of the botanical nature of the Geneva. The tasting notes on the finish of the rosé vermouth are kind of similar. So your bitter liqueur is really your binding agent for
yeah.
them to all lead down that same path. And you're right, it is lighter, crushable in the language of the cocktail
yes,
world.
Yes. Quaffable, if you will. Well, Phil, we've got about a minute left before we're going to close out this liquid luggage segment here. So tell people where they can find you first and foremost, and tell people with these three, with the vermouth, the Tuve bitter, and the by the Dutch Geneva. Find
yeah.
out more about those.
To find me online, I've got a website, Phil M, as in Mary, Brokerage, philmbrokerage.com. And I've got, if you need to reach me, there's a contact button. You could just shoot me an email. As for the spirits, these three products come from the same portfolio. It's an OG importer, a guy named Henry Price. I know I've mentioned him, and he's maybe been a guest on your show in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to priceimports.com. You can there's a PDF catalog document, and there are actually active clickable links to every single brand that's in the portfolio. And it'll give you a great, you know, one-page description of every product and some tasting notes and
awesome.
Some cocktail suggestions as well.
It's a really good presentation. That's PRISSImports.com. Friends, Phil, thanks for liquid luggage number two, buddy. We got liquid luggage number three coming right up.
Yeah.
Friends, if you're listening on the radio, please do go get the podcast, NOLADrinks.com. And we're going to, yeah, if you're listening on the podcast, you're going to hear liquid luggage number three right now. And if you are, again, friends listening on the radio, now more than ever, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all.
like this. I said, I call your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. Then he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your ear. It don't matter who you're serving, we're all the same down here.
All right, everybody. Yep, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. Always happy to have you here hanging around with us on the Nola Drink Show. Hope you're enjoying this conversation we're having with our good pal Phil Minasalli there of PM Brokerage. A lot of interesting and tasty stuff. And as we mentioned before, we just did our second installment of Liquid Luggage number 2. And depending on when you're hearing this, that will be available very shortly as a standalone thing. And you're about to hear Liquid Luggage number 3, which will also, a few days after we roll out number 2, number 3 will roll out as a standalone. You can just go to our website, noladrinks.com, scroll down a little bit on the homepage. You'll see a banner right there for Liquid Luggage, and you can get all of those once they're out. They're these two once they're out, right? Number 1's already out. Go get it now. Friends, we're going to bounce right back over to Liquid Luggage number 3. Here we go. All right, everybody. Yep, Liquid Luggage episode number 3. We are here with our good friend Phil Minasalli from PM Brokerage. And yeah, we are still in the midst here, as whenever you're hearing this, of our coronavirus situation. Act 2, as I'm calling it right now, because the world seems to be sort of opening back up. Not going to put any sort of value judgment on that. But we are sitting in Phil's living room here, properly socially distant, and we're tasting some interesting spirits with him. Proud to bring you another episode of this. And Phil, we've got 3 really interesting things that you and I always go back and forth when we put these together about sort of how do we group them in a way that we can make some connections, but, you know, talk about them in a somewhat succinct way so you can come away with news you can use. I'll put it in that term. And so we've come up, I think, with a really interesting lineup of 3 things that we're going to taste. We're going to taste a Raicia by Estancia. We're going to taste a particular Pisco, La Diablada. And then we're going to taste Tracal, which is a very interesting Patagonian spirit from Chile. And we'll tell you kind of why we grouped all these together. But we're going to start with the Raicia, man, which is an interesting agave distillate.
Yeah.
I'm going to say interesting 3 times.
Yeah. If you tuned in to episode 1, we talked about El Buho Mezcal. So mezcal is a category in Mexico. So tequila is classified a mezcal. So really the translation is cooked agave. So if they're cooking agave in the distillation in the production process at all, that is a mezcal. Now tequila is the most popular mezcal, but mezcal artisanal is really, really becoming the next trend in the bartending community. And what separates tequila from a mezcal per se is that to be classified on the bottle to describe it mezcal, it needs to be 100% agave. And I'm sorry to break it to some folks out there, but some of the tequila that you're drinking is not 100% agave.
Many times it can actually just be 50% agave, right?
Sure.
That's the minimum, I think, isn't it?
Here's my rule. Yes, it's 51%. Yeah. It needs to be a majority. So my rule is if it says 100% agave on the bottle, that's a tequila that you want to buy and grab on the shelf.
And it's going to be blue agave, right?
Yeah, well, yes. Okay. So that location, and that brings up an important point in regards to Estancia and tequila as a category. Estancia can use multiple agaves, but it comes from the same state as 95% of all tequilas, Jalisco. Mm-hmm. And that category of mezcal tequila, I know it sounds all confusing here, but I'm opening up your world to
absolutely the world of agave distillates. It's a big one.
So yes, it's huge. Tequila will use 1 agave. The only species allowed to be used is the Blue Weber agave. So agave azul. That's every tequila that you're tasting.
That's real tequila, as
that's
you
real
defined
tequila
for us before.
And remember what I said before, 100% agave. It has to be communicated on the bottle. That way you know that your tequila is, in fact, 100%. Because they do have regulatory bodies in Mexico that control this, the CRT, the Certified Regulatory Body of Tequila, and then you have the CRM, which is the regulators of mezcal. So more jobs are coming out and about to regulate these products. Raicilla is a fun spirit and an agave spirit that sort of is, it's born out of like rebellion in the area of Jalisco, because most of the fields were just, they were all Blue Weber, and it needed to be that because the growing brand of tequila as a whole required that, hey, this is the rules that we set forth for tequila to be a category. We need to utilize all of the lands, the hectares for Blue Weber.
And so this was more in recent times, right? We're not talking about going back generations
of making mezcal. Don't quote me on this, but I think it was like 1948.
Yeah, or something like that. Something it's 20th century, for
yeah,
sure.
Right, where tequila became its own category, recognized, and then started to be one. You know, that Blue Weber agave. That was the sole. That was the sole agave. And before, I'm sure it was all like they produced it in the same way as artisan. They did. They produced it in the same way. They cooked it in the ovens. You know, the like artisanal mezcals. And then when the ovens, you know, the big ovens became like the industrial methods. When industrial production influenced Mexico, it influenced mezcal as a category for tequila production.
Right.
Because that was the most recognized.
Mm-hmm. And needing to crank it out to satisfy market.
Needing to
demand.
Crank it out. Yeah. Like, so the artisanal producers, they're still digging the pits. They're still cooking the agaves, you know, with the stones, and
still a donkey turning in and crushing it.
Yeah, still got the horse or the mule like running around and crushing it. This is what the government regulates for the production. So to get more specific to Raicilla, as I was describing, it comes from Jalisco. It comes from the highlands of Jalisco or the coastal areas. So where, you know, the large plots of land don't exist for the Blue Weber agaves, for more of the commercial productions of tequilas or the industrial productions. So it's rustic. Mm-hmm. And the initial element of this was it didn't have to have taxes. So the initial products, you know, the bottlings of Raicilla, it didn't fit the requirements to be classified a tequila from Jalisco. It was able to avoid some of the taxes.
And more locally consumed than and all that.
So the story of this particular one, this guy Rio, who is an expat, lives in from Australia. So his grandfather grew up working at the Tecate Brewery. And his favorite drink was Raicilla. He knew some local producers of it, and they used to just fill the old Coca-Cola bottles with Raicilla and drink it.
Yeah, there you go. With your friends and family, and
So when Rio started to see the growth of mezcals across the U.S. and other countries, he said, maybe this is worth really kind of diving into the history of this again.
And this is now obviously more in contemporary times.
This is one of two brands that is imported into the United States.
Okay.
So Estancia and another product called La Venenosa. That was the first one to ever reach the market.
Okay.
Estancia is now the second. They still stay true to that story to some degree. They actually use recycled Coca-Cola bottles for the glass.
Oh, really? Oh, no
so
way.
That's an homage that. To that. His okay. Grandfather.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So these are glass blown, and they're it's a beautiful bottle. It's got etched on the side.
Yeah, you can find the pictures on the website.
Estancia,
yeah.
This beautiful symbol. So the translation of Raicilla is little root. They use a small agave that grows on, it could be small, it could be large. It depends, right? The wild agaves might reach maturity in 6 years, might reach maturity in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no litmus to when this is going to mature.
Okay.
You know, unless you're using the clones, then you have a better idea of how, but there are issues to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is really special. It uses the Maximiliana agave.
Okay.
There are other types of Raicillas that will use other types. But again, you're typically not going to see a ricea that uses blue Weber because it's rustic and they don't have access to those types of agaves because they're owned.
Gotcha. So which agave is it principally?
This is 100% the Maximiliana agave.
Okay, so this one is 100%.
Yeah,
okay.
Which is known as lechuguilla. Lechuguilla is the name of the agave to the Mexican community
local.
There.
Okay. And you take a sip, Phil. I love this. And I'm just not saying that just to say that. It is one of my favorite things. As you know, I'm a big, and listeners know this too, I'm a big mezcal fan. Been a big proponent of the category, the story, the cultural components, the whole thing for quite some time. I love it. And ricea is one of my favorite things because what I love about it is it brings some of my favorite characteristics of mezcal. There's that rustic note in sort of a good way. There's a touch of that smoky note, but it's not overly smoky. But what I love about it is there's a smoothness on the mid palate, which is beautiful. But then kind of what I'm building up to is there's a floral and there's a honeysuckle note on this that just kills it. And that to me is just like, it's great in a cocktail. It's great by itself. I am such a fan.
Might I interject with some cheese?
And some, yeah, and it has that kind of cheesy note. Right, absolutely.
It does. Yeah. It does. I love this to just sip on with a cheese board. Mm-hmm. I think mezcal is the greatest spirit to sip neat and with a variety of foods. So there's so many characters that you can get. Like, I totally understand the tradition of drinking tequilas and some mezcals, right? You have it with a little bit of citrus. But also, have some savory food with it, too.
Absolutely.
Like, some chips. Like, I know grasshopper, you know, might scare some people off, but chapulinas, that is...
Yeah.
There's a reason why they will pair that with mezcals, because it does give you, like, a little bit of that salty and savory character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, the cricket itself, like, sometimes has a citrusy character. Mm-hmm. Like, there are some ants out there. They have, like, a defense mechanism that gives it, like, this citrusy flavor.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I knew the Cipollinas, but yeah, okay.
Some company in the UK made a gin from infusing it with the ants called anti-gin.
Oh, how clever. Anti-gin. Okay.
Anti-gin.
Yeah, I get it. Oh, boy. We need one of those now, but in a very different way, like in a vaccine.
Right.
But
yes.
But this is just beautiful stuff, friends. And I mean, I think it makes great cocktails. Like, certainly sipping it by itself. Don't get me wrong. That would be my preferred method. But if you're making like a nice cocktail with a bit of some like floral characteristics, it stands up really well. I also think it stands up really well to some sort of creamier kind of drinks as well. Like, if you're making something that has some mouthfeel to it, that it kind of cuts through some of that. And it brings just this light, like a lot of people might go, I'm not a huge mezcal fan because it's too smoky. That the smoke note on this is so much more restrained than a lot of, you know, mezcals that you may have tasted before. It's there, but it's not the predominant thing.
Sure. So they're going to be roasting these in like this big clay oven. Whereas in artisanal mezcals, you see it like they dig the pits and they're throwing it over some hot stones and then throwing some of the fibers from the previous mash that the donkey or the mule did. And that's basically on the stones to cool it so it doesn't burn the agave. You don't want to like burn the agave.
Then it becomes ashy, right?
Right, very right, unpleasant. Right. And it'll get like a bitterness component in the distillate or like that tiry flavor that you can get
rubber
with not so good mezcals.
Yeah, exactly.
So this really, it's a very, very specific time frame from them throwing them in like the really hot clay oven and then immediately cooling it and getting them out. So they're soft. The juice spreads across the agave. It softens the piña that they're easily able to grind it up
like,
and
like
get
letting
the juice.
A piece of meat rest then to let the juices spread back through.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I would say like you don't want it to leach out. You want it to still stay intact within the actual piña.
Okay. Let's move on to the La Diablada. This is also one of my favorite expressions. Again, not just saying this, one of my very favorite expressions of pisco that I've ever had.
Yes. So this is from, if you're familiar with your pisco, this is same producer, Machu Pisco. This is Melanie and Lizzie Asher, female distillers that go down to Peru to Ica, where all the piscos are made, and they make this acholado. And an acholado is a blend versus a pisco puro, which will be a single grape distillate.
Yep.
One thing to remember about pisco from Peru And I say from Peru because Chile can also make pisco, and which will segue into our next product. Mm-hmm. But pisco from Peru follows a very strict rule. It is a one-time distilled product. It can't have any additive whatsoever, and it's distilled to proof.
Yep.
So when you think about how we make our spirits in the U.S., you have to think about how we talk about vodka, right? Mm-hmm. And the sexy thing cutting about it, vodka is, oh, this vodka is 18 times distilled or this or that. And that talks about the purity of it or how special it is. This is, you're going from all the yeasts that live in the environment that live on those grapes. And because of the proximity of where it is, those yeasts, they're like super yeasts. They're like the superhero yeasts that live there, and they're able to pull out so much more sugars and aid in the fermentation process. So you're looking at a one-time distilled product from an initial fermentation, or essentially like a wine, into the distilled product.
Yes.
And Melanie and Lizzie go above and beyond the measures of producers to ensure that this product is organic. So they are actually creating the partnerships with the farmers directly, because what happens in any massive food industry, they're going in there and these farmers are not maybe just producing grapes, you know, they've got other types of produce.
Sure. And they're trying to make a living.
And they're trying to make a living. So,
easier said than done to keep it organic.
Yep. And big companies will go down there and say, hey, we can increase your yield. This mm-hmm. is how we do it. We're going to come and we're going to spray. And they get these farmers on contracts to come every year, two times a year, to spray them, keep the insects away. That will keep the birds away. And they're yielding more crop. However, you know, there are people that are opposed to this because they want their organic foods.
And I know that with Machu Picchu, they're very big on the health of their workers and the people where they're sourcing the grapes is a significant part of the story. I will tell people to reference we did a show with Lizzie Asher, one of the two that you just mentioned, the two siblings, and I'll put those in the notes as well. So if you want to go back and hear more about the broader category of pisco. And we also did a show with Donnie Ronan on pisco. I'll put both of those in the show notes where we get more into depth in this one. But this is a blend, the achelada, which means blend, basically. That's what it means, is several grapes. I love this one, man, because it has, like, to me, it's kind of what I want pisco to be about in a certain way. It has a nice floral note to it. It's not overwhelming. It has an earthy note to it. It's not overwhelming. There's a white stone fruit to it. It's not overwhelming. All those flavors are present. It's not weak. It's not flabby, but nothing overpowers anything. And there's a beautiful balance in this, and you taste the terroir in this. And it to me, pisco is one of those ones that it's if you're a wine fan, this is the closest thing to drinking wine as a distillate that reflects terroir. And I would say mezcal is a close second, but this to me is that.
Sure. When I first saw this bottle, I noticed it looked different on the label. So Melanie has released a few piscos in the past to celebrate the anniversary of the Pisco Sour and the centenarian. So they designed one specifically that worked with the Pisco Sour, then the 100th birthday of their grandmother. And then this one was to celebrate, you know, her life after she had passed away. So she lived to be 102 years old. So this one has their abuelita on it, and Melanie said, oh, that's what we'll call it. We'll call it the abuelita blend.
Yeah, perfect. And it's cool. And the one that I'll link to, Phil, on the show before when Lizzie was on, we tell the story about La Diablada and the dancing and things like that connected to that. So I'll refer listeners to that one. But this is tremendous. To me, I want to drink this one neat. Not to say it wouldn't go fine in cocktails, but
sure.
To me, I just want to drink this neat. And usually how I have this is I just like a pebble or two of ice. I don't want chunks of ice. And I do room temperature is just fine, but just like a pebble. and it just gives a slight dilution to it. And I know sometimes, like at the end of the night when I've had a little bit too much, I will go into a bar, and especially if they have this one, and I'll say, like, two pebbles of ice. And when they pull out two cubes, I go, no, I mean two pebbles of ice.
Take that cube, smack it with your bar spoon, and just give me two pieces of that.
Exactly. And it's like perfect. It's like, when I don't want any more beer, I don't want any more whiskey.
Brian's back again.
Huh? Yes. Sorry, Jesus. Let me complain about your ice program. And I do that. It's a beautiful, beautiful expression of Pisco.
Coming to a bar near you, I will talk about your ice
program. What cocktail hero stuff right there. Yeah. Well, cool. So beautiful stuff. And you'll be able to find links to that and more. You'll see the picture of the bottle
on
the website.
Last comment on
please,
this.
Please, please.
Tasting note on the nose, lychee fruit.
Like lychee, white stone fruit, like I was saying before. Absolutely.
Some strawberry as well. So like I do like to have this one with a nice fruit plate. Because it really accentuates that citrus, will bring out a lot of flavors.
Good call. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So now we're going to move into a very third one, and we'll talk about this after we make a cocktail. We talk about this one for a few minutes. All of these, you're probably gathering what our theme here is, a sense of place, and we'll circle back on that in a second. But this is a really unique one because this one isn't necessarily a spirit that's been made for a long time. Actually, hasn't been made that long at all, but it very much has an interesting sense of place to it.
That's correct, and dive back into just Pisco as a whole. I might have mentioned that Chile also produces Pisco too,
yep.
But it doesn't follow the same criteria.
Sure.
It doesn't have the strict rules of production. So Chile does have what they would call their spirit as Pisco, but it's not made in the same way. They can use rectification stills. They can use the column stills. They can impart flavor after it's finished. You can put it on wood. Yep. So some people would prefer the Chilean Piscos. I prefer the Piscos that are made in Peru.
I put it this way, Phil. They're two different things.
Sure. They are two different
and
things.
And we shouldn't even really... Yes, it's called the same thing in the two places, but I just kind of want people to stop calling them the same thing. They're just two different things. If you take them as two different things, your life will be a lot easier.
Well, sure. So there is that issue between...
I'm not talking about politics.
Yeah, not the politics, but if you were to just have a battle between the two places, they could battle and discuss Pisco regarding anything else that's happening. But what I love about Tracal is this...
This is what we're tasting now. We didn't quite say it yet. Tracal. Yes.
Tracal is the product that is made in Chile. So this is made in southern Chile and the region of Patagonia. So Argentina and Chile have that area of Patagonia. And what they've done is two guys that love to backpack. They were backpacking all across Patagonia and they said, well, if we were to one was coming from a spirits background and said, well, if they were to make a spirit, had the equipment to make any product from here, what would they have made it from? Because, of course, any spirit with a sense of place uses its local ingredients. Trade was not a big thing. So if they had the equipment to do it, what would they have used? So they started to research the local supply chain of food and local supply chain of local drink. In Peru, they make something called chicha, and chicha is corn. And if you've ever had that, you won't forget it. It's pretty rustic. It's like drinking a wort of a beer. Mm-hmm. Really, really sweet. I like it. I had it on the Inca Trail one time.
May or may not involve spit, right?
Yeah, how it's fermented. All the process. We won't dive into that on this show.
I think we've talked about it before. Yeah. Actually.
So chicha in Chile though is in that area is crab apples and pears. So that is their locally, organically fermented product. It
makes sense. Cooler environment as we get further south away from the equator.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So they connected with some local chicha producers, and then they did a first distillation of that. So the idea was to just have a brandy that was local to that area, and they realized, well, this isn't as complex as we want it to be. So they thought about how you make a spirit more complex and you add a little bit more citrus that can help in the botanical nature of things. So they did a second distillation with some local berries and local berries, and that kind of rounded it out a little bit, made it a touch more balanced. And then they were influenced by people that were just hiking all the time, and they were like, walk through here and smell it, smell the jungle here. And they were like, that's what we need to do. So they started just picking a whole bunch of herbs off of the, you know.
Were they kind of drawing on local knowledge too? Like
things
that obviously that people were like,
absolutely.
We use this, we don't use this,
They couldn't have done it without the support. And one of the founders lives in Patagonia. So a guy named Sebastian Gomez, he is the idea guy that kind of went into the jungle. Ben Long is the U.S. partner that is a big backpacker and kind of heads up all of the U.S. import and sales in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And they work together on developing the product. So the first distillation, like I said, crab apples and pears. Second distillation, local berries. And then third distillation, all the native herbs.
Local botanicals, yeah.
And one that stands out is called Tepa, T-E-P-A. And this is not something that's ever been introduced in a spirit before. And when you smell Tracal and you go to Patagonia, this is what you're smelling.
It's a hard to describe smell too, because I think
that's the wrong glass.
Ah. At least you know your difference there. That's good. it's interesting because I think I've never smelled it by itself because I've never been to Patagonia. But I think I get what you're getting at of what's unique in here. And I can't articulate it. I'm almost at a loss for words because any descriptor that I would want to give to it would almost sound kind of negative. But it's like, it's so good.
What I do hear commonly is that it does have like the characteristics of like anise or...
It's kind of close to anise, right? Mm-hmm. But I almost want to say like rubber, but people will take that as a bad thing. It's not like a poorly made pinotage from South Africa. It's very, very pleasant. And
yeah.
I mean, and so that's why I'm all kind of struggling. I think anise is a really good example, but there's more of a bitterness in a good way than anise usually has.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, and look, and bitter's your friend. I love bitter. And so I'm not talking about bitter being a bad thing. I'm talking about bitter being a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that kind of note, and there's this very sort of earthy, foresty floor. There's a good positive way to put it. Foresty floor kind of note to it. Almost like earthy, mushroomy kind of note.
Interesting. That was like the whole idea of this spirit.
Oh, really?
They should
hire me for marketing.
as when people walk through and had the experience. I mean, and they of course want to support that. It's an amazing part of the world. I had the pleasure of going down there in February before all this. To think I could have got quarantined there, it almost breaks my heart.
Yeah, that would have been really bad.
It would have been terrible, just backpacking, hanging out with the local farmers. It was an amazing experience, but it really hones in on what this product is all about. It's about the soil. It's about the connection to the place. Which why I sought it. It falls right in line with what I was trying to do, and it complements our community quite well. We are a very early adopting community to new things, to strange things
here in New Orleans. Yep.
Here in New Orleans, and when I first introduced this, people were like, you know, on that like, whoa. What is this? This is something I never tasted before.
Man, I'm telling you, Phil, I had the same reaction. And sometimes, like, you know, when you start to hear the story and it's like gringos going down to make something and things. And I'm always a little skeptical having lived in Latin America and stuff and done whatever. I'll spare people that part of the story if you've heard it before from me, if you listen to the show a lot. And, you know, I'm always skeptical. And then, yeah, it's like, whoa, what is this? I had a hard time getting my head around it.
Sure.
And I had a hard time sort of categorizing it. Now, I think it works fantastically in like a Pisco Sour variation. Our good friend Chris Ulueta at Sylvain has made a very nice drink out of it before. It tastes nice by itself. So, I mean, I think you can kind of look, if you're talking about, you can put this in almost any place that you would use a clear distillate. Like you can use this in place of gin in many instances for a lot of drinks. It's going to make a nice martini, mm-hmm. I think, in a lot of ways. So it's a very versatile thing, but it is very different, but in all such a positive way. And there's two other flavor notes that I'm going to throw out at you. I get a little bit of pineapple and I get jasmine. That's maybe kind of what I'm looking for on the floral.
Okay. I do get mint.
Mint. Yeah, there's a little bit of that minting that kind of.
Minty will be, you know, and they use two types of mint in the botanicals. So seven different herbs and botanicals will be used in this. And laurel.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense too. Absolutely.
So it does... and you know, on your note of being able to sub this for the classics, I mean, first, when you grab a bottle of Tricol, go at those things. Like, sub it for your vodka in a martini. Sub it for your gin in a Negroni. Just, you know, we've done it on a previous show with the Geneva.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can introduce Tricol in that same cocktail. And I really like to approach the tiki world with Tricol.
It fits nicely. And it's going to bring, like, that earthy note to things that I think would be very interesting to play into mm-hmm. certain things.
So there's the Jungle Bird, big cocktail in the tiki world. So the Andean condor is the bird of Chile. So Flight of the Condor is what we call that cocktail.
I'm hearing the ripoff Simon and Garfunkel version of El Condor Pasa in my head right now. Thank you. No offense to Simon and Garfunkel.
Sure. It is a fun one to tackle your classics with and just see the diversity of what the spirit can do in the other realms. But like you and I are saying, this, when you first are introduced and taste Tricol, there is it's almost hard to find a comparative.
It really is, and all in a very positive way, which is very unique. And again, as I mentioned before, I'm sometimes skeptical of things like that when I hear the marketing language, and then the first time I taste, I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Well, let's do this, Phil. We're going to take just a brief musical respite because we've covered a lot of ground here. But you and I are going to come back in just 1 second, friends, maybe 10 seconds. And we're going to taste a brief little cocktail, and we're going to put a brief commentary on sense of place. Yep, we're right back here with Liquid Luggage episode number 3, friends. And Phil, you've made me a very nice Tricol cocktail here. Very simple, right? A little grapefruit juice, a little bit of a liqueur.
That's it. If you want to sweeten it up, you can use a simple syrup if you want. But I really like to introduce Tricol in a very simple way initially, so people are familiar with how it tastes. Because once you've tasted it, like you'll recognize it in every other cocktail that you had. It really finishes. Where I've seen people use it is like just like this. This is a nice sessionable cocktail. A little bit, like 1.5 ounces of Tricol, little soda water, and some fruit juice. That'll bring your sweetness up a little bit, and a little zest of an orange or a lemon or a grapefruit.
So I think what we did here, we needed this over ice, and we'll spec this on the website.
Sure.
But you know, 1.5 ounces of Tricol, about 1 ounce of grapefruit juice.
Mm-hmm. Not a ton.
And then top it up, maybe 1 ounce of sparkling water, right? Or club soda.
Yeah, I mean, you could use like one of the fruit juices at the store as well. But I like to just use like the 100% grapefruit juice and then splash it. Get your effervescence from your soda water.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we get the nice acidity from the grapefruit juice.
Yeah. Tonic works too. If you like, that'll bring a little bit more sweetness as well.
Absolutely.
But club soda or soda water.
I'm going to go on a limb here because it's also a personal taste kind of thing. I could put a float of Angostura bitters on this and be perfectly happy.
Cool. Yeah. There you go.
But I mean, I could drink buckets of Angostura bitters. So that's a different story.
That's a thing. People shoot Angostura at bars.
And there's a few drinks that are Angostura based drinks. That's a story for another time as well. One called the Bucket of Blood that I helped create. Long story.
All right.
I'll tell you about it off the air. So Phil, I think what we've gathered here in Liquid Luggage number 3, this was kind of our point of this tasting, the Estancia Raicia, the La Diablada by Achelado Pisco by Machu Pisco, and then, of course, the Tricol, the Patagonian spirit from Chile. All these things have very much a sense of place. So they reflect the terroir. Sure. They're using local ingredients. Obviously, the Tricol is a modern distillate here in this sense. But these things all bring a sense of place. And that's what we wanted to kind of connect here. I think that was the theme of Liquid Luggage number 3. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, it falls in line with what I've had as my vision for the company, for my brokerage and consulting, is really bringing unique spirits from all across the world. And it really shows that from the original methods of production, like what can be born. So you look at the Estancia, you look at the Pisco, like these are things that are traditions from that area. Tricol, sure, a little bit of a different story, but you know, it goes on that basis of like, hey, well, if they had the ability, what would they have made it from? You know, regionally, how could they have sourced all the botanicals and the ingredients to make the product? And it really makes for an easy pitch when I talk about a product. I'm saying, hey, this not only tastes delicious, but it gives you, you know, an ability to discuss something further, not just about the spirit. And we know we love to talk to our bartenders, and giving them this knowledge about a product, they can extend it past the bar and connect on a deeper level, you know, with the spirit.
Right. You connect the flavors, you connect the culture.
Sure.
Through that. And I think that's fantastic.
And each one in their own way is putting forth a way to support their local communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point too. Let's do this, Phil, before we close out. Liquid Luggage number 3. I have to enunciate that very clearly, especially after we've tasted through several things. Yes. Where can we connect with these three brands?
Sure. They all have a digital presence. Estancia is going to be Estancia, Estancia dash Raicilla, Raicilla .com. Machu Picchu, which produces the La Diablada, is Machu, M-A-C-C-H-U, Pisco, P-I-S-C-O .com. And Trakal is spelled T-R-A-K-A-L, and that's just www.trakal.com.
Awesome.
So that's how.
And PM Brokerage.
Oh, yeah. My website, Phil, P-H-I-L-M, as in Mary, Brokerage. com.
And you do some cool videos. You have an Instagram presence.
Yes, I do have an Instagram. You can connect to the Instagram through the website, or I'll just tell you it's Phil, P-H-I-L, Minisale, M-I-N-I-S-S-A-L-E.
So. Very good. And all of this will be linked, if you're not taking notes, and I hope you're not, all this information will actually be on the website. We'll link up to everything, and we'll have a little bit of the spec on the couple cocktails that we, over the last couple that we've tasted in Liquid Luggage number 2 and Liquid Luggage number 3. And Phil, I look forward, buddy, to doing Liquid Luggage number 4 with you pretty damn soon, my friend.
Cool. Tomorrow? Sound good?
Sure. We got a lot of time on my hands, and you got a lot of nice booze, buddy.
Perfect.
Friends, that's Liquid Luggage number 3. And I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show this week, friends. It's always a pleasure to have you around here on the NOLA Drink Show. Just a quick programming note for you. You got to hear Liquid Luggage number 2, and you got to hear Liquid Luggage number 3. Those will both be available shortly, and again, this depends on when you're hearing the podcast, as standalone little vignettes on our website. Just go to noladrinks.com, scroll down a little bit, you'll see a banner that says Liquid Luggage, and there you will also find the first one that we did, and as we mentioned, I think I said this in the show notes, actually, that we kind of got upended. We had just started doing this in a particular way before the coronavirus pandemic struck, and that sort of derailed our plans, and so we brought it back, of course, very excited to do so, and very happy to do so, but it's not quite the full Monty, necessarily, in the way that we intended to do it, because what we did in the first one, you'll see it there, are video demos of a couple of the cocktails, a little bit more extensive cocktail recipes, you know, a larger number of those. And what we plan to do and what we did there is highlight a local bartender who shares the recipes and does the demo. So hopefully we'll get back to that soon. But we will have a couple of the cocktail recipes, I think one for each Liquid Luggage installment for number 2 and number 3 on the website shortly, as well as some photos of the bottles. And you'll just be able to hear that segment by itself. So there you go. Be on the lookout for that. Friends, this is our parting shot. And something, you know, got me thinking when we were talking about Phil's book, meaning what products he has in his portfolio. And he tries to emphasize having something that demonstrates a sense of place. Certainly, we've talked about this on the show before. We've talked about terroir, for example, and how terroir is not just the physical environment. It's also the social components, right? The people, the culture around which something is produced. And that's, to me, an integral and important part of terroir and its definition, and also obviously that relates to sense of place. Now, I think we know in the liquor industry, there's a lot of bullshit out there, being frank about it. Now, I'm not going to put a value judgment on the quality of some of these products, because sometimes a lot of these products that are full of BS with their marketing materials and stories aren't necessarily bad products, but it's just the crap that they do to try and sell us something. Now, I get, look, you have to market
And having a sense of history in your story and things like that, I think is important. But where I'm going with this is stuff that's actually meaningless or stuff that's kind of untrue. One example that springs to mind just recently, Corona Beer put out their hard seltzer. Of course, it seems like everybody has to have one these days. They put theirs out and their marketing message is made with pure beach vibes. The hell does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. As a matter of fact, they kind of screwed up. This is a story for another time, or go look it up. You know, the whole coronavirus thing in Corona, they kind of came out of the gate on the wrong foot with their hard seltzer and changed their marketing campaign to this pure beach vibes thing. It absolutely means nothing. Now, I think there is probably no greater culprit of this type of stuff than the whiskey and bourbon world here in the United States. There are examples everywhere of all kinds of just basically untrue mythological stuff, as well as just straight up untrue storytelling or marketing. For example, Templeton Rye was sued in 2015 because they were using terms like small batch and handcrafted. Tito's does the same thing. There is no legal binding aspect of what that term means. And so people were, you know, they got sued for false advertising and misleading marketing. As a matter of fact, Templeton Rye is made by a very large company that many of you maybe have never heard of. They're called MGP. They are a large spirits producer based in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. They actually operate out of the old Seagram's distillery. They're one of the top five or six largest distilleries on the planet, from my understanding. And basically what they do is they make stuff for other people. Now, I don't have a problem with that. Look, if you want to try and sell a 10-year-old bourbon and you've only been around for a couple years because, you know, the market demands aged bourbons and these things, I get it. So you can go out and source it and stuff. Just tell me that you've done that. I don't have a problem. I get it. And look, a lot of people, they think it's a bad thing. But what I think is worse is when you're being untrue. Tell me that, you know, this is the stuff that you source because it fits your flavor profile. This is what you're going for. And give us another few years and we'll be making and putting out our own 10-year-old. And in the meantime, here's something that we made that's young stuff right here on the premises. So MGP makes the stuff. They made the Templeton Rye stuff. They made stuff for Widow Jane, who got in trouble a couple years ago, the hipster bourbon out of Brooklyn, New York. They were claiming that their water for their 10-year-old bourbon came from the Widow Jane mine in New York State. And they weren't even making their stuff. MGP was, as I said. And then now that they've started to apparently make some of their own stuff, they're actually still apparently, allegedly, not using water from the Widow Jane mine. They're using it from a neighboring mine. And as a matter of fact, people were calling into question some of their actual backstory discussing the origins and ownership of the mine itself and who Widow Jane was. And again, something to go look up there. But, you know, come on, don't lie to me. That's just BS right there. Another one that springs to mind, of course, is Old Vine. You hear this term a lot in wine, especially associated with Zinfandels. Old Vine means nothing, friends. If you see it on a bottle, it basically, there's, again, the TTB, the regulatory agency in the United States, they have no definition for what Old Vine means. Now, look, there are plenty of winemakers that I know that I used to deal with that use that term, and they try and give it some amount of truth or integrity, like they won't call their Zinfandel Old Vine unless it's 40 or 50 years old. The vines, of course, are 40 or 50 years old, but all bets are off, and there's a lot of people I've seen stuff that I know damn well is less than 10 years old, and they're calling it Old Vine on the bottle. It doesn't mean anything, and in reality, too, it doesn't even really mean a whole hell of a lot when it comes to quality. Sense of place does mean a lot to me when it comes to quality. Now, again, sense of place, yeah, that's history. That's your story, especially if it's a true one. But to me, sense of place is also something about the here and now. How do you operate in your place? Are you a good community member? Do you give back to the community? How do you treat your employees? Are you good to the environment? These things also relate to sense of place. Sense of place is not just backstory or history or your decades-old distillery that does this. It's how you operate today. How do you source your stuff? Are you being truthful with us when you tell us how you make it? Be truthful. It's cool if you source something from somewhere outside your area because it's a key ingredient and that key ingredient doesn't grow in your area. Just be honest about it. You can have a great sense of place if your product reflects where it is that you come from, even though every single component doesn't come from your backyard. That's okay too. Just be honest about it. So sense of place to me, friends, is not just, again, about history and story from yesterday. It's about how you write your story today. I'll pay a few more dollars a bottle for something that represents that, and I will certainly pay a few more dollars a bottle for something like that as opposed to something that tries to BS me with some mythological, dusty origin story. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to